It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper? A woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver. If you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. Choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Save big on your Thanksgiving feast, all in the Kroger app. Buy two, get three free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up with your card. Then get a juicy frozen grade A Kroger turkey for 49 cents a pound, limit one with a $25 additional purchase with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Another Breakfast.com podcast. My name's Stuart Wright, and today's guest is Stephen Follows. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I've been a long-time fan, so it's really great to finally be on the other side of it and have a nice chat.
Indeed, indeed. Now, you've come to talk about your mammoth, if you don't mind me describing it that way, horror movie report, and three films that have impacted everything in your adult life. So, without further ado, shall we jump into the report?
Yeah, let's do it.
Before I start asking some questions about it, do you have a kind of, like, people would have a synopsis for a film. Do you have a synopsis for your report that captures what it is from your point of view?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because it's as always with personal projects, you have your own vision of it, but it's only when people start to use it, or in the case of a movie, they start to watch it, that you start to see it reflected back and you see it through their eyes. So for me, I spent a year studying the data behind horror films. And so all 27,000 something horror films that were made, feature films over the course of the last century and a bit, I've crunched the numbers on the content of the films, the people who made them, profitability, all this sort of stuff. And then it's about 300-400 charts and graphs across 450 pages. And it comes in two forms. One is for film fans, which is sort of like most of the things I just talked about. But there's a film professional version, which is probably more the people that are the audience here. It's got more stuff on budgets, profitability, but it also comes with all the data, permission to use it in business plans, all sorts of things like that. So that actually it's of use. My aim is that I want to help people get their films funded, made, and seen. Like, so that's, and it's everything about horror.
Okay, right. Now, horror fans, if you look at them first, they can argue the toss as to what and what isn't a horror film. So for the purposes of your report, how did you define for yourself what makes a horror film as opposed to what sits outside of what's a horror film?
It's such a good question, and it's one that I obviously had to deal with a lot. And the funny thing is, it's going to sound strange, but I disagree with my own report sometimes. What I mean by that is that I have to have a reliable metric to do all these numbers. And so I looked at whether enough of the certain key sites called it a horror film or not, and then used that as my measure, because then at least it would be consistent.
Yeah.
But there are some in there that I would not call horror films, and there are some, I mean, these are fringe cases, but I think Chitty Chitty Bang Bang is a horror film. I think the first... Well, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory is a horror film. I think that the Eddie Murphy film Haunted Mansion is not. I think it's got horror aesthetics, but it's for kids. And for IMDb, for example, doesn't call Silence of the Lambs or Jaws a horror film. And I think you could make a case they are. Maybe Silence of the Lambs, psychological thriller. I don't know. Where do you sit on those?
Well, it's that you hit the nail on the head. I think Silence of the Lambs is the bellwether of it all, because that's the one that people seem to get knickers in a twist the most about, as far as I can understand. And I think the other one would be Seven.
Yes, that's a great one. I mean, but also you then have, because quite often they are ones that sit within another genre really squarely, and then they have horror elements, like Pan's Labyrinth is a good example. Mm. Like, I don't think most people would call that horror, but some might. But the numbers does, but IMDb and Letterboxd don't. And then you have things like Black Swan that Letterboxd does. I think IMDb doesn't, the numbers don't. And then Hellboy. Again, so like these are all films that have different aesthetics. And I think that what we're doing here is saying that horror isn't a defined thing. Mm. It is an experience. And we obviously, when we're doing numbers or we're putting a DVD on a shelf or we're doing a selection on Netflix, we do need to have some classification, but it's important to have the humility to remember that it's all kind of nonsense. And it's a necessary nonsense. And it's not as simple as, I mean, I'd say a supermarket has clearer aisles than a movie experience has. But, you know, every filmmaker will complain that their film has to be boiled down to a genre and can't be sort of two genres. Whereas in fact, we know as filmmakers, we want complicated experiences, don't we?
Indeed, indeed. There's the sales agent needs a genre, and there's a filmmaker that's going, oh, I blend this, I take tone from there, I have this theme, and it's about the art. And obviously a marketplace is more a supermarket than it is an art gallery in the end.
Completely. And I think that what marketeers are saying is not that it is or isn't a genre. They're saying, I can't sell it as one. And like, that's a lot more complicated. That's why they say drama is not a genre. It is absolutely a genre, and they know it is a genre, but they don't know how to sell it. And I appreciate that. I mean, it's not, they're not being lazy. You have a film that's won Cannes that's got Julianne Moore. I still don't know what that film is. I don't know what experience I'm going to have. You tell me there's the Terrifier 3. Let's use that as an example.
Yeah.
I already know how I'm going to feel. and I either want that or I don't. So as far as marketing, that's clarity. But let's not confuse that with the art. You know, it's a necessary evil, but it's a different evil.
Indeed. So 27,000 plus films is a mountain. You know, it's a K2, it's a Mount Everest of films to consume and study and analyze. How do you consume 27,000 plus films? I'm guessing you haven't watched 27,000.
Yes,
films.
I'm glad you said that because it would be disappointing for me to have to say that. So my friend Cole, who runs IMDb, I think he's seen about 15,000 movies and he watches about three a day and has done for decades. He is my measure of what the edge of human endurance.
I thought you were going to say he's commitment. Your hero.
No. He's my measure. He's my benchmark for. I see him from time to time, and I see how committed he is to watching movies. And I'm like, I cannot do that, and I cannot even do that for a week. And he has done it for decades, and so he has only reached about 15,000. So I am nowhere close, and would not pretend to be. But it does raise the question. So I mean. I did a version of this horror report about 8 years ago, and it was only about 9,000 films because far fewer had been made back then.
Yeah.
And there I was using a lot more of the basic surface level metadata where you might say what genre it is, who's in it, how long it is. You know, the information that you might get from an IMDb page, for example, is the sort of like there's loads of bits of metadata associated to a film. What I was able to do this time around was I did all that, but I also did stuff that's wholly different thanks to the world that we're living in now. So I would, for example, I can get all of the plots from Wikipedia. I can identify who are the leading actors based on the credits and say, okay, so I know that, you know, Dr. Jones, played by Brad Pitt, is this person's main protagonist. I can then take the text, go to an AI and say, tell me the journey this character has in this piece of text. And then I'll know whether they survive at the end of the movie or not. Or we don't know. Quite often the answer is we don't know. And it's not really using a brain of the AI. It's not really saying, watch this. Is this good film? Is this good art? It's none of that. Like, it's not anywhere near good enough to do that. But it can do a very narrowly defined task 27,000 times. And so what I end up with then is a data point of hero survives or doesn't. And then I look at it over time and I see that in that example, for example, if you look over the last 100 years of horror films, the hero is dying far less often, but the allies are dying far more often. That's so pleasing as a kind of, and we can discuss why and all that kind of stuff. But that's the basic process where it's not all AI. A lot of it is me doing stuff, but it's sort of gathering all sorts of data points, and then analyzing them to produce new, interesting insights, and then putting them into a pleasing, simple graph that empowers everyone to have a conversation. Because that's my aim. My aim is always to empower everyone to talk about it. And I hate when people shut conversations down with data or facts.
Yeah.
That's the opposite. What I'm trying to do is say, okay, well, this is true when I did X, Y, and Z. Now, you can say X, Y, and Z isn't the right thing to do, or you can say that we have different reasons for why it's happening, or even that it's an anomaly based on something else. That's all great. That's the good stuff. Mm. But so my job, I think, is to go away, turn chaos into order, and then come to everybody and say, hello, everyone. This is what I found. What do we reckon?
Well, that's a beautiful segue, turning chaos into order. Because I did wonder, if taking your subjective view 8 years ago and now in the present with the new report, your own subjective perceptions as to how you understood horror as a genre and all that, what that included, what for you has been the most surprising facts that you've sort of disproved or proved things that about you, what you even you understood becomes a fallacy,
yeah,
or becomes bigger than you ever thought it would be?
Well, there's two, and one is sort of industrial and one is more artistic. So the industrial one is I was just staggered by the number of films. And I knew there were a lot before. And we also know that in the last 20 years, many more films are being made because it's functionally so much easier. I mean, my doorbell has an HD camera. Like, everything could make a film. And I went to film school in 2001, and I remember scratching the negative. So, like, I can understand there are more films. But not only are there many, many more films in general, but horror has a larger percentage of the production than it did before. And it was, you know, a few percent in the middle of the last century, and now it's about 12% of movies. So it's growing in a growing market.
Yeah.
So in the 1980s, there would have been 150-odd horror films made in a year worldwide. Hmm. And now it's over 1,500 a year. So the first thing is just the industrial scale of growth of both film, but also of horror and the acceptance of horror. That was the first thing. That was the industrial side of, wow, that's a surprise, even to me. Hmm. And it continues to grow. Like, there's no dip yet. I mean, there's a slight tick down from the COVID year, but slight. And then it's still gone back up again. So I don't know when it will plateau or fall. But I mean, I think I calculated that horror will become, every movie will be a horror by about, hold on, I got the exact figure here. Oh yeah. I think I calculated that back of a napkin, that if the current trajectory of horror as a percentage of total films carries on by 2104, so in less than 100 years, every film will be a horror film. Now, obviously, that's not going to happen. I'm just saying that that's the direction of the line. Anyway, so that's the industrial one.
Yeah.
But the artistic one that really sort of blew my mind, but and it was a lovely journey I personally went on where, and this happens a lot, you take a messy data set, you organize it, you strategize, you know, you figure out what you need to clean, and then eventually you get one graph or chart that's sort of the headline one. Mm. And it sort of answers your main question. And that's the moment of aha, you know, like, suddenly this now makes sense. Sometimes it doesn't make sense, and then you have to go, oh, what did I do wrong? And quite often you've selected the wrong, you know, column, or you've done something. Anyway, you sense check it all. And I was looking at the average shot length of movies. Yes. And so this was over a lot of movies. This is like between two cuts. How long is the average shot length? And unsurprisingly, action films have the shortest, at about 4 seconds on average, across all films, across all kind of parts of the movie, you know, the action sequences and the sort of drama. And I expected, or I just presumed, that horror would be short. But actually, it's the longest, at about 16 seconds. And so I thought initially, I was like, oh, I've made a mistake. And I checked it, and I was like, no, that's true. And then the penny dropped. Of course. Because horror is about control. It's about the artists controlling what we know, what we see. We can't see around the corner. We can't see in the box. We have to hold on not knowing. Or the reverse. We see the killer slowly walking towards the victim. And we're saying, get out of there. Don't run upstairs. And they don't. And so it was one of those journeys where I understood more about the horror genre through the data. It was right in front of me the whole time, and I didn't see it until it was such a clear result. And then it was the most obvious thing in the world.
One of my I taught a couple of years ago at film school, just teaching sort of story and concept development with undergraduates. And we looked a lot at just generally box office information. And there was one week that I read something about horror, which has stuck with me ever since. In the UK, horror is the only genre of film that is watched by, and this is in the box, in the cinema, not at home, that's watched by a demographic that is equal to the demographic of the UK.
That's my research.
That's me.
I found that out, and I love that. It's such a good stat, isn't it? Yeah. It's so great.
And every other genre skews to a richer, a more wealthier audience, doesn't it?
Posher. Yeah, totally. And some of them, like drama and biography, are crazy when you compare them to the population. There's nothing wrong with that, but it doesn't represent the population. Horror is the only one where it's the average of people, and I think it's because it is it's got no pretense about it. Like, you can, someone can, well, this film is important, and one can, and most people will be like, oh, okay, they won't challenge that. Whereas if a horror film's bad, everyone will call it out. Like, that's bad. In the same way, if a comedy's not funny, they might go, that's not funny. And so it therefore has to live and die by whether it actually delivers to the audience. Does it actually entertain? Is it actually what the audience want? And if it is, it'll go to number one. You know, Blair Witch, great, whatever. But if it's not, it sinks like a stone. It has no safety net. It's filmmaking without the safety net. And I think that's great, because I think it means that when it works, even if the critics say, I mean, that was the thing that got me first into studying horror maybe 10 years ago. I was doing a piece of work for the American Film Market with Bruce Nash, who runs the numbers. And we looked at the correlation between the critic scores and levels of profitability for all different genres. And we found that for everything other than horror, there's a very high correlation between what the critics say about the film in their scores and whether it makes money, like really high. So it basically makes sense to make a good film. I mean, yes.
Be critically acclaimed. Oh,
that's the reason people would or wouldn't, but that's, you know, there we go. But for horror, yeah, exactly. If you can, do so. It's probably a good financial decision. But for horror, it's functionally irrelevant. Like, it's just statistically, it's all of the graphs are really flat, and then there's this little sort of tiny little one down the edge. And basically means it doesn't matter what critics think. And also, audiences tend to give horror the lowest score of all of the different genres. And there can be films like The Purge, which has got pretty poor scores. Not the worst, but bad, but incredibly successful. Mm. It's because when we give scores, we're asking a sort of a question about the art. When we go with our money, we go where we want to go. You know, no one's saying McDonald's is the best food. They're saying they feel happier when they eat it, or that it's convenient or whatever. And horror is kind of, there's a parallel. It's not exactly the same.
No, there's no free toy.
I wouldn't call it but it is sort of the same kind of thing.
Yeah, I wouldn't. I mean, I think in some instances it feels like gatekeeping, but there's politics with a small p, not a big p, within the horror community. So if you hang around,
that's it.
If you hang around Frightfest long enough, or Grimfest or Sitges, and you talk to people who are watching films, there are definitely camps of people. Like, I find it hilarious there are people that seem to resent A24 even exists. Like as if it's inviting people in who shouldn't be, who aren't horror enough. I mean, it's a very, there's a great parallel between horror and heavy metal, in the sense that it doesn't exist in the mainstream, yet it makes all the money. You know, it's, you know, Iron Maiden, yes. Iron Maiden befell in a stadium in South America and nobody knows about it. And, you know, Terrifier 3 is now making bigger box office than The Joker, which obviously horror does exist and there is a horror audience. And it's a real weird contradiction.
It really is. And what bothers me a lot is that the way that the mainstream critics write about this is as if they've got no memory. Is it like they're from Finding Nemo? Because they're like, wow, why is this horror film making so much money? And then next year, another film does it, and they're like, wow, why is this? And you're like, because you're not updating your mental image. You're snooty, and you think, I mean, that's why I think, I mean, this is a now very personal opinion rather than a piece of data point, which is that's the phrase elevated horror. Mm. Now, there's nothing wrong with elevated horror films. There's nothing wrong with drama horror. Like, great, everyone should have their type, and this is like The Lighthouse and whatever. But the term sort of implies that most horror films are dirty. They're dirty films. But I have enjoyed this film. And that is strange, because I do not enjoy dirty films. So therefore, it must be a different type of film. And I will call this elevated horror. And then everything will be okay. And the real truth is, no, you liked a horror film. And that's okay. Because your image of horror films was of crappy little films that you thought were made by crappy little people and no one watched it. And you're wrong on all fronts. And but, you know, as more films are horrors and there are more horrors, it's a bigger church. You're going to let more people in. That's fine. You know, I don't mind what brings people to the pulpit, the offering.
It baffles me that this idea that what we're seeing, certainly with your Neons and your A24s, is somehow new. When we live with a canon that includes Don't Look Now, Rosemary's Baby, and the like, which are elevated genre before the term was ever dreamed up, or even The Shining, you could argue, you know.
Yeah, it's totally.
It's a huge family drama with horror around it. How can people get your report, Stephen?
So that's a good question. Thank you for asking. If you go to horrormoviereport.com, I mean, I really could do with some help getting the word out there, because it's one of those things where I don't need to convince anyone to buy this. If you hear there's a report out there that's 400 pages that is the stats of horror films, you are either hell yes or hell no. Hmm. And I am not moving you on either of those things. I promise you it is that, and I promise you it's nothing else other than that. And so what I'm trying to do is just spread the word so that people know it's there, because my main mission is to help filmmakers and to use the skills and the information I have to empower the people to make whatever they want. Like, there's no hand on the scales. I don't mind what you make with it and what you do with it. So if it's for you, go and have a look. There's lots of details about what it is on horrormoviereport.com. But if it's not for you, but it is for someone you know, send it to them. Because I really do want this to be something that can help filmmakers, because quite often they're told, oh, you need a proper business plan, you need to make your case, you need to use data, and then they're left alone and not given any. And I get emails from people who are kind of, I know I should do this, but I don't know how to do this. And I'm like, well, yeah, I get it. It's really hard. And this is going to help. And so I really want to get the word out there so that more people can just start making the choices that if they're swithering over two choices, then they can make one based on data. Or more likely, they know what they want to make because they're a creative and they've got a vision, but they need to be able to explain it and prove it the way that you might have a lawyer to say, like, I know I didn't do it, but what's the words I need to, like, what, how do I, you know, what's the process? That's where I can help. So yeah, please help me spread the word, because I want to help more people through this data.
Yeah, because it's very much about it. The report's not about telling people what to do to make a horror film. It's about it's a reflection of what's happened, and for you to understand the context of what you're about to enter.
Yeah.
Which isn't dictating totally what you should and shouldn't do, but knowing what you're doing and how, where it
there's fits. No formula. And yeah. I you know what? Actually, it's funny. Bruce and I, so Bruce runs the numbers website, and he's sort of box office analysis and probably the best person doing all that sort of stuff. We had I was over in San Francisco where he lives a few years ago, and we were having a drink on his veranda. And I said to him, and I just realized that actually the two of us, we're not the only two people, but we're two of the people who have all the stats and the data and spend the time doing it. Hmm. And I said to him, do you know what's going to work? Because often people ask me, and I was like, I don't think I know what's going to work in any predictive way. And he thought about it and he said, no, but I know what will fail. And I was like, that's great. And because you can't make, if you make the same mistakes everyone's made before, or you make things for an audience that doesn't exist, or you do things, you know, you make a family film with some swearing in it, that's easy to say, don't do that. But then all bets are off. Make stuff with art, make stuff with passion, make it the best and innovative as you can. And then it'll land where it lands. And I find that so supportive. I like that. I wouldn't like it if there's a formula. And I promise there isn't one. And you can tell I'm not gatekeeping it because I'm not rich. Mm. If there was a formula for making films that made it work, my God, Hollywood and someone else would have figured it out, and the trillions that have gone in over the years. There's not. It's the business of art. Business is about making the same thing again and again. Art is about destroying things every time. The interplay of the two is a perpetual motion machine that is kind of fun and distracting for your career and your expression. That's where we are.
Yeah,
and so some people over-index one way and some the other.
Yeah, because in a way the entertainment media industry, like the trades, are the opposite to the daily news. Like the daily news is, if it bleeds, it leads. Now, in extreme, if a Venom or as what's just happened, which is one, Joker 2, becomes the news story, but they'll resist it. It has to be reported outside of the trades, then they can reflect it. But more often than not, the trades are about what's succeeded, because it's about perpetuating success. So what we don't hear really from our film journalism is the tens of films that didn't succeed. What we hear of is what happened. Like, for the life of me, and just to prove your point about that there is no secret sauce, I finally got to see The Substance. And as a horror fan, I cannot believe a film that gave that many zero fucks about what it was doing, A, won an award at Cannes, and B, is doing gangbusters at the box office. You know, that blows my mind. And you could, and I know that there would have been a conversation, and also working title have worked on it. You're like, those don't add up. So the formula could never have made sense at the beginning. But
Ryan Seacrest here. When you have a busy schedule, it's important to maximize your downtime. One of the best ways to do that is by going to ChumbaCasino.com. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino games like spin slots, bingo, and solitaire that you can play for free for a chance to redeem some serious prizes. So hop on to ChumbaCasino.com now and live the Chumba life. Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply.
Save big on your Thanksgiving feast. All in the Kroger app. Buy two, get three free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up with your card. Then get a juicy frozen grade A Kroger turkey for 49 cents a pound. Limit one with a $25 additional purchase with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It obviously does deliver on something. You know, I'm sure you could retrospectively look at some of the numbers and look at substance and go, this is what it does right, I suppose, in reflection of what you see as success.
Yeah, and I think the thing is that there are some things that you can say almost never work. Like, for example, Westerns or sports films typically don't tend to work. But then you can always find some that do great guns, and you might be one of those 1 in 10. 1 in 10 is terrible odds, but if you might be one of those 1 in 10, because It's very hard to predict, but it's not random. And I think in the middle of those two facts, like, you know, if we say that 1 in 3 independent films are profitable, it's about that, give or take. We're not saying that you have a 1 in 3 chance. That's not what that means. It means that of every 3, one of them does. But that one is probably a better film made by more connected people who've done some research and had a bit of luck, as well as talent. And there's a few unlucky ones in the 2 out of 3, sure. But I can't remember who said it, but there's a great quote about success in life is down to luck. And I find the harder I work, the luckier I get.
Yes.
And so the more research you do, the harder you work on your script, the more you get feedback, the more you're open to different perspectives and you work hard, probably you're increasing your odds of your film on that every week with every roll of the dice. I don't know.
Thank you for sharing all that about your report. It is definitely food for thought, and I'm glad that there's no secret sauce and no formula, but I'm also glad to know that there are definitely things you can do wrong and avoid, which makes for a perfect report. So let us move on to 3 films that have impacted everything in your adult life. Now, for those that haven't heard this before, Stephen has given me 3 movies. We're going to do them one at a time. We'll do them in the order that you gave them me. And at the end of 5 minutes, because that's the limit on the time, as a bit of jeopardy, we will hear this sound. Which you can hear at your end, Stephen.
Yes.
Brilliant. Okay, then. Without further ado, the clock is ticking on 1999's The Matrix. Why is this such an important film for you? Where did the fond memories stem from? What are the memories?
Yeah, well, I was a teenager at the time, so obviously I enjoyed the sort of visual spectacle, but that's not the reason I picked it. The reason I picked it was that I was actually in America when it came out, and I was over on an exchange program, and I didn't know what the movie was going to be. I was there on a date, and I just didn't care. Like, whatever the movie is, sure, we'll see that one. And I saw Keanu Reeves, and I was like, oh, that's a shame. But by the end of the movie, absolutely loved it. Like, you know, paradigm shift of visual entertainment. But then that was sort of maybe May, something like that. Then I came back to America, back to the UK, and then no one here had seen it, and it hadn't come out, and it wasn't going to come out for 6 months. And I saw, exactly, it must have been 6 months or so. And so then they started to have the teaser marketing campaign of what is The Matrix? And that's all it said. It was the first time I had ever had information outside of the way that you get it from Empire magazine and trailers and stuff.
Yeah.
And I could see the marketing people's challenge. This is a finished film. How do they sell it? And so for the first time ever, I felt I understood a marketing campaign for a mysterious movie, and also what they held back and what they showed and what they told people, and also how you explain a complicated movie. And it was fascinating. It was just like seeing behind the curtain once. And I was at the age where I was trying to understand the industry. So it really helped me see that, as well as it being an awesome film, which still holds up. I watched it recently with someone who hadn't seen it before. It's still a solid choice.
No, it is. It is. It's for screenwriters, it's a perfect story in many senses. You know, as fact as it's wild and high concept in sci-fi terms, in reality, it's the perfect hero's journey, coupled with just the notion of something as simple as the red pill, blue pill thing.
Which
you know is an amazing obstacle, as it were, because it's just completely existential. It's not real. It's not, you have to fight it.
Yeah,
and then for it's, a film, and it's taking so much part of the lexicon. You know.
Exactly. I mean, it's so complicated and so simple. It's so powerful. It draws on so much pre-existing philosophical thought, but doesn't require you to have done the reading. It's visually exciting. It's got the perfect acting. It's just perfectly cast, and it looks great. Sounds amazing. The sound is incredible. And it was just really important to me. And I remember I saw it with knowing nothing. I'd never seen a trailer for it. Didn't know the film existed. Didn't know what it was. And I just walked into the cinema and saw it. I will never repeat that cinematic experience in my life. That is too perfect.
Well, I was blown away by just some simple facts that I found out. The opening action scene took 6 months of training, but only 4 days to shoot. And you're talking, what, 5 minutes on screen? I mean, that's a hell of a tale, isn't it? From 6 months to prepare.
And the amount of money that must have been there as well. Yeah. But at the same time, it shows. It's you put the effort into something like that, and then you know as an audience member, this is something special. You could knock that out very, very quickly, and it would just be a weak version of it. And we've all seen weak action films.
Yes.
But when you put the work in and it's quality, you can feel it in every breath. And I think that film just screams quality and care and love.
Talk us through, as you went to see it at a cinema in America, do you remember what the cinema was, what it was like?
No, it was in New Jersey. And I remember, I remember at the end of the date saying goodbye and her saying, look, make sure you get home all right. You don't know where you're going. And I was like, that's fine. And then I texted her that I was lost and being mugged, and I wasn't. And I was just messing with her. So I remember little snippets of the experience, but mostly I remember Keanu Reeves. He was the person that sort of stuck with me from the date. But it was just an average sort of dive cinema. It was perfect.
What in the sense of your perception was Keanu Reeves wasn't going to make a good film, and then suddenly there's
because I've seen the last thing I'd seen him in was Johnny Mnemonic. Like, he's not good. My impression of him was not a good actor. I now take that back. I was wrong, and I'm a huge fan, but I hadn't found the rhythm for him. You know, like every actor needs the tuning fork of who they are. Yeah. I hadn't found his, and I was wrong, and I found it in this film.
And apparently he lost 15 pounds to do the Neo wakes up in the pod scene, which is a commitment to your art, isn't it? I mean, I know a lot.
And he shaved his head. That's a commitment in Hollywood. Real hair gone.
What for you? I mean, do you have a favourite scene from the film? I've presumably watched it a few more times since.
Yeah, so, I mean, God, that's a damn good question. All the stuff with the helicopter is incredible. Like, visually, it's so tense. I know what's going to happen. I've seen it 10 times, but it's still just so tense. And it's just so exhilarating when things work out. And the training sequence is also very good as well. Like, do you think that's air you're breathing? Like, what a great line delivered so perfect.
There's the alarm, sir. Perfect. So that was The Matrix. Moving swiftly along to possibly the absolute other end of the sci-fi spectrum with the... I did a podcast once called Five Great High Concept Lo-Fi Sci-Fi Movies, of which this was one. I'm talking about Shane Carruth's Primer from 2004. So do you want to talk us through what impact this... Why this had impact on you and, you know, where you saw it, what memories it holds?
Where did I see it? 2004. I graduated film school in 2003. So I don't know whether I saw it. I probably didn't see it in the cinema. I probably saw it on TV somewhere.
I'm a VHS.
On DVD.
Mine was definitely VHS.
Yeah, it might have been. I don't know. It's a film that cost $9,000 and they shot on film. It's also all about the script. And when you watch the director's commentary, it must have been DVD because I saw the director's commentary almost immediately afterwards. The director, who's one of the actors, says, oh, look, you can see in this scene, I say the word cut. Because they had no spare, you know, their shooting ratio is almost 1-to-1, and you can see his mouth say cut. It's so taped together with duct tape from every technical standpoint, but you don't notice, you don't care. The script is so good, and it's complicated as hell, but actually it's so exciting that it really showed me that, like, there's no excuse. If you can make a time travel sci-fi film on such little money I've spent more on short films, other people's money, but on short films, I have no excuse. There's nowhere to hide. I'm not saying it's easy. I'm not saying everyone can do it, but there is no excuse. This film proves that a good script just shot cleanly, successfully, can just take you, and it's exhilarating without any sort of action. Like, without there's nowhere to hide. I think that's the point. I think that's it. There's nowhere to hide in that film, on the script, on the screen, in the acting, but it works and it proves that you don't need anything. Nothing's a required element for success.
Yeah, well, I mean, like I say, I mean, I love a lot of films that are that run under that banner of high concept, sort of low production values. And that doesn't mean that it's rubbish. It means it didn't cost a lot. So, you know.
Yeah, that's all it means. And I still have to give it an hour and a half. I still have to give it 10 quid, whatever. I as the audience member, have to give it the same attention I'm going to give something else. And so you should deliver exactly the same. I think that's what people don't realize. A lot of filmmakers are like, well, it was only shot for this. No one cares. And that's a good thing because it means you can compete with something bigger. Mm-hmm. Terrifier 3 can compete with Joker and win easily if it's better. But you don't get any bonus points for, well, I know it's crap, but it was cheap or it's, it's a level playing field when it comes to my time and attention, even more so now on Netflix. When everything streams on the same TV in the same place, I just want to be entertained for the minutes I'm watching that film. But I will give you what I would have given Avatar 2, my time, my money, my advertising dollars, whatever it would be. And so it is, I mean, obviously there's a lot of unfairness in the middle of the the process of distribution. I'm not suggesting everything's a complete meritocracy.
Yes.
But fundamentally, what other businesses, what other types of things do you as the audience pay the same no matter what the ingredients were? You buy a sandwich, you pay roughly what you get. Roughly. Yeah. You buy a burger. I mean, burger is probably the best example. You can probably get one for £1. You can certainly spend 100 quid somewhere, I'm sure. And you'll have different ingredients. Film doesn't work like that.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's great.
If I run out on the pitch at Anfield with the other 10 players, people will notice who's not the professional footballer.
Yeah, at some point, 10 minutes in, 20 minutes in, whatever it would be.
Yes. It would be self-evident that...
But film's not like that. Film, yeah, sorry, go on.
I was just going to say, I mean, what's interesting about it's a while since I've watched it, and I was just reading about what people had said about it. And one of the interesting things I thought about, and in terms of sci-fi being sometimes a complicated idea delivered simply, they never use the phrase time machine in Primer, the entire film, which the idea that they held back that information, and yet they didn't need to tell you, because obviously it's about what evolves out of the action. So you understand it's happening. You understand the box, as they call it, is a time machine of some description. But how time travel works, how they're traveling through time and how far doesn't matter. It's just what the fuck happens next.
Be honest, I don't understand why that film works. I've seen it many times. I don't, and I'm not saying confusing plot. I'm saying that film breaks so many rules. If I was making that film, I would have ruined it 20 times over with my notes. I would have been very confident. Oh, you need to do this. You need to explain that. And I would have been wrong on every single one. And I don't know why it works, but it does. And I'm sure there's the same of, I think adding cucumber to a cheese and pickle sandwich makes it better. And I don't know why that is, but I know it does. And I think it's the same thing here. Primer is an inexplicable movie that proves that art and passion can ride over any rule you create.
But I think that's the privilege of the low-budget movie, in a way, because if you haven't got all those cooks trying to cook the broth with you, I'll finish this thought. if you haven't got all those cooks trying to finish the broth with you, then you don't have to worry about, because all you get with other opinions is, oh, that won't be understood. And you're like, well, it's bleeding obvious to me, so I'm going to stick with it. And that's a lot of what happens, certainly with just general stories. I can imagine with something that's as complicated as multiple time travel and people existing on different planes. I mean, I'm in the process of watching Lost right now, and I'm in series 5, and they're literally just making things up now, as far as I can tell.
I stopped after 3 for exactly that reason.
But it's wonderful. It's wonderful because you understand what they're doing. They don't have to explain it very much. And you can tell.
Well, it's Christopher Nolan and audio, right? Like you don't hear all the dialogue, but his point is, I don't care. You get the feeling of what I'm going for.
Yes.
And I can see both sides of it. It's irritating, but at the same time, he is right.
Yeah. Because if you watch Primer, it is like your elevated genre stuff. It is slow burn. It is about immersing yourself in the process of what's going on, not hanging on every word and making sure you've heard everything.
Absolutely.
Back at you. Whereas obviously, with The Matrix, there's cool lines of dialogue and stuff. Right. Moving swiftly along to our third choice and jumping back to 1995 for a Clint Eastwood-directed movie that I've not seen, if I'm perfectly honest with you.
Outrageous.
And just thinking of your first film being such a big idea, this one is about a photographer that meets a housewife and they have 4 days together in the 1960s. I mean, you couldn't get a smaller film idea if I tried.
Yeah.
But tell us why this is a meaningful film for you.
So this is The Bridges of Madison County. And the way I discovered this film is that a friend of mine and I used to go into his house every few weeks and he'd rent a movie, or one of us would take it in turns. We'd rent a movie and we'd watch it. And this was a while back. So this was a DVD. And we'd agreed what movie we were going to rent. I can't remember what it was. And I went around to his house and I said, oh, did you get the movie? And he said, oh, no. Not only did I not rent it, I saw a movie on TV last night that was so good, I rented that instead. And we're going to watch it. And I was sort of slightly not offended because he was a close friend, but at the same time, he's taking some liberties here, right? And I was like, okay, what is it? And he was like, oh, it's The Bridges of Madison County. And it's not a kind of film I would have watched. Oh. And I'm like, okay, there's a lot riding on this. I trust you and I love you. But at the same time, if this is rubbish, and I was crying by the end, it's incredible. You should watch it. It's a masterpiece in cinema in every detail. It is so good. And so I love the film. It's one of my favorite films. But also the discovery process showed me, first of all, I could enjoy so many more types of films than the ones I'd been told I would like, or I had, you know, you watch copies of copies of copies and you end up in a very small spectrum of what you watch, whereas actually what you want is good films, well made. It's the best acting you'll see ever. Meryl Streep is just stunning. It's so beautifully directed by Clint Eastwood, who's also in it. And also the villain in it, if there is a villain, but you know, all stories need an antagonist, is the concept of fate. And they never say that. That's me sort of analyzing it afterwards. But it's just, what you described is 100% the plot. It's not that there's a twist. It's not that there's something else. It's just done so perfectly that you can't stop but love it. And the end of it is incredible. And not because it's a big flashy twist or whatever. It's just stunning. I promise you, if you watch it and don't think it's one of the top 20 films you've ever seen, I'll take you out for dinner. It's just great. And I think that it's not only good to watch, it's also edifying to be reminded that you can say, I don't watch this, that's not for me. But at the end of the day, if it's good, it works. And I don't understand how it's so good. I don't understand how that film works, but every time I watch it, it does.
And I think that your friend's decision to shift your dial for you is a bit like the principle of, like, you know, like when you're listening to the radio and a song comes on and it's a song you really like and you enjoy it because of the surprise. But whereas if you were to put the song on your stereo,
absolutely,
it'd just be wallpaper. And
yes,
equally with algorithms going, if you like this film, then you'll like that film. And you're like, that's not how this works.
Exactly. You could only be derivative based on what you were before. Yeah. I have a different friend who went on a holiday and they were in an Airbnb and the previous whoever has previously rented the place had left their login for Netflix on the TV. And my friend said it was the best thing ever. We had a holiday from our own preferences. And it's such a good idea, right? And he has an idea for an app where you basically swap a login with someone else so that you get to see their choices for a week or whatever. Because he said it was the best thing about the holiday was that they all watched, oh, I've never been recommended that. I'd know that. And yet that they would like come home to their own recommendations. So yeah, getting stuck in the black hole, the spiral of ever decreasing recommendations, I have to be reminded to take myself out of that. And that usually happens from someone else doing something or a film festival or something that is forcing, quote unquote, me to do that. But when you do, you get to discover stuff and it's even more joyous because I would never in a million years have watched that film. But the way he forced me to watch it made it one of the top cinematic experiences I had.
I mean, I wouldn't call this the greatest cinematic experience I've had, but I remember being taken reluctantly, as dates often can be, to see Sense and Sensibility, and coming out having thoroughly loved it. Now, there's nowhere in God's green earth I would have gone, circled that in the newspaper or whatever and gone, that's this week's entertainment sorted.
Yeah.
But it was a really good, you know, the movie was a good movie. The story was a good story.
Because we are more nuanced than the cartoon version of ourselves that we have, that people tell us, chick flicks, films for boys, whatever, genres for boys, for girls, like that is all bullshit. And it's convenient in the short term in the same way that stereotypes are largely true in many cases, but they're wrong in every single way. You often, on average, you don't need to look left or right when you cross the street because it's probably not a car. But every time you stand there, you should because you might get run over. So every time you make it, you might have a generalized sense of what you like, but every time you pick something, it needs to be about where you are now.
Indeed. Well, there's our 5 minutes up, sir. And that's our three films that have impacted everything in your adult life. Thank you very much for sharing that with us.
And thank you. That was really fun to think about that and to then think about the choices. And also the way you phrased it was great because it wasn't like, tell me three films that are good.
Yeah.
And so they became a highly personal thing. And I thought back and I've enjoyed those memories and I've enjoyed, you know, chatting with them and with you. So that's been a real net positive to me. So thank you for that.
My pleasure. I mean, that's in a way that was the format because, you know, there are 100 ways that you see this is the best whatever. And best is so subjective, whereas memories associated with films are equally subjective, but then they become things that other people can reflect on, which is beyond the film you're watching. I think your story there at Bridges of Madison County, and thank you for introducing the title to that section, is a great one because there's that we've all had that experience of the friend who said, "Oh no, I thought we'd watch that." I mean, I'm a bugger for it at home. My wife will say, "Can we watch this?" And I'll suddenly see there's a new offer, and I go, "Oh, can we not? That I want to see that." Mm-hmm. And suddenly I'm the one moving the dial. Well, look. I could talk all day. Actually, one thing I would like to ask, and it came to me after you finished, who was your friend, colleague who watches three films a day, the 15,000?
Oh, Cole Needham. He set up IMDb.
Okay, so Cole...
He runs IMDb.
So Cole running IMDb, has he told you what his secret is to three films a day as a thing, you know, as a habit? Because that's a lot of your day.
I think he's very rich and gets invited to lots of screenings and film festivals. I don't know if that's very useful. He's always at film festivals. He's at screenings. But I bumped into him once at the London Film Festival. He was standing outside the Curzon Mayfair watching a film on his phone outside, and he was watching the credits. Hmm. And I said to him, hey, Cole, what are you doing? And he was like, oh, I haven't finished. We had to leave whatever the screening was last night because of whatever reason. And during the festival, there was a streaming service to catch up. And I just wanted to finish the movie and finish, because he watches all the credits as well. And I just wanted to complete it. So I would say that his main secret is probably commitment. He is committed to what he loves films. He's committed to the bit. And therefore, he puts the effort in. I don't think it's mystery. I think it helps that his work is his passion as well, because I think that helps. You know, when you go, and if most people go and see a movie, they're bunking off work. If he sees a movie, he might be helping his job. But other than that, I think he's just very committed to it, really loves the medium. I mean, Ted Hope's the same. Ted Hope doesn't, the producer, he used to run Amazon Studios and probably, I think he's produced more Sundance winning films than anyone else. He doesn't really watch TV, but I don't know what his numbers are, but he's the only person I know who probably could give Cole a run for his money. But he doesn't watch TV. He watches movies. And so he's so attuned to the form of movies.
And produces a prolific newsletter, which I had no idea.
And also the funny thing is that he's so prolific. And also he will send emails that are long, like just we're chatting. He'll send long emails throughout the night and whatever. I don't know when he does anything, and yet he does so much. It's not like it's just like he's all doing it for show. He's just works incredibly hard and is very prolific. And, you know, I'm so jealous of both those people. Well,
let's remind people then, how can they get the Horror Movie Report?
HorrorMovieReport.com or Google it, because no one else has done one. As I said, if you're interested, come and have a look. If you know someone else to be interested, send it to them, because you might be doing them a favor and you'll definitely be doing me a favor. So yeah, please.
Okay. Well, I'll put links in the show notes, and it just gives me to say thank you very much for joining us on the BritFlix podcast.
Oh, it's been an absolute pleasure. And thank you for bringing those films back into my front of my memory. And it's been such a joy to talk to you about it. So thanks again.
Hey, it is Ryan Seacrest. There's something so thrilling about playing Chumba Casino. Maybe it's the simple reminder that with a little luck, anything is possible. ChumbaCasino.com has hundreds of social casino-style games to choose from with new game releases each week. Play for free anytime, anywhere for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Save big on your Thanksgiving feast, all in the Kroger app. Buy two, get three free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up with your card. Then get a juicy frozen grade A Kroger turkey for 49 cents a pound, limit one with a $25 additional purchase with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.